It's Wednesday, and we're back doing the Andy Milburn Show. We were supposed to talk about this on Monday, but we're just getting to it on Wednesday. And so we're going to be fairly disciplined, which is atypical of this program. But the article's called When Not to Obey Orders, written by Andrew Milburn. And Andy joins us again. Andy, first of all, thanks for doing this.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Mac. This has been terrific. You know, the only thing absent in our conversations is a bar and some beers, but otherwise just as enjoyable.
We've talked about this a lot on All Marine Radio, and so as we talk today, as you can relate it to Vietnam, as you can relate it to the decision to go to war in Iraq, as you can relate it to the expansion. The undertaking of the ground war, the expansion of the ground war in Afghanistan, I'd like you to do that. But talk to us about where does this article, and the link is this link again is in today's post, so if you're looking for it. Talk to us about the evolution. Where does this article come from?
So, Mac, when you and I went through TBS and IOC, and this follows on from the discussion we just had, we learned that you obey all lawful orders. The only time you disobey an order is an illegal order. You know, it seemed that at the time that the very fabric of discipline, the thing that holds not just a unit but the military at large together is the sense of loyalty and obedience. And that is not wrong, to a point. You know, discipline is important. But then for most of us, I would like to think for most of us, let's just say for many of us right now, as we progress through our careers, we realize that just like a lot of things in our profession, it's not quite as cut and dried as that. And sometimes you find yourself, and I'm going to use the term obligated to disobey an order. Now, I'm going to take a very disciplined approach to this discussion because people go, you know, high and right when they hear me start talking about, the obligation to disobey an order. So I can root what I just said very firmly in some core tenets of our profession. You know, our oath to the Constitution. All right, our loyalty not to any individual person. I'm going to come back to that because that's something that's often referred to, but I think little understood because it's not always easy to understand. The second piece is professional ethics. And if you're a military officer and you do not think you belong to a profession and you do not think that we have a code of ethics, it may not be written down, but it's at least an implicit code of ethics. If you don't think any of that, I would hope that no one I know ever has to serve under you. And the third piece, and this again is something that didn't really start to become apparent to me until several months after I graduated IOC. The third piece is your obligation to your subordinates. Now, we always learn that it's the mission first and then the men.
Right.
And you know, again, that's a tenet that seems so absolutely obvious that it's inarguable. But at times it is arguable. Because what happens if the mission makes no sense? What happens if it's the wrong mission? What happens if you get given a task for which you know your guys are going to die for not only for no reason, but the mission itself is going to set the cause back. Are you just going to simply execute? So those are all things that come into play here. Now at the highest levels, when you get up to, you know, those of us, you know, not, neither you nor I, but when you pin on general officer rank and you get to that nexus between policy and strategy, the implications of following orders or you know, the decision whether to push back on orders or resign or just simply execute has far-reaching effects. So, you know, this is all linked. The discussion of whether you as an officer have an obligation to exercise your moral autonomy in that gap between receipt of order and execution it applies equally whether you're a junior lieutenant or you're a four-star general or admiral, discussing or being involved in, hopefully, in a forthright discussion about execution of a military strategy in pursuit, hopefully, of the coherent policy. All right, that's kind of the academic approach to this. And I think it's important for all of us, your listeners, to understand that I'm not, hopefully, yeah, I mean, you may know I'm wacko, but I'm not some guy pushing here for a controversial topic so that I can get published. This cuts to the heart of our profession. It's not a trivial topic. In fact, a more recent article published in War on the Rocks that kind of pushes back a little bit on my argument, but it's a well-written article, says, hey, this is absolutely a fundamentally important topic, and not just to military officers. It's important within our society. All right, Mac, I'm going
to... Well, let me, why this is so important is that it's immoral to ask the citizens of this nation to donate sons and daughters to a cause that isn't linked to your grand strategy, that you're not absolutely certain that you can make real in terms of your nation's future. So to me, you know, everywhere we've gone, yeah, we've been escorted by the flag officers and the general officers of the United States military. And I would tell you that, you know, we all knew in Iraq, in 2004, we didn't have enough ass there. We didn't have enough bodies. We're playing whack-a-mole. And so why don't we have enough bodies? Well, because the Secretary of Defense ripped up the war plan that called for over 300,000 Marines and soldiers there, right? And he wrote his own plan. And so nobody called bullshit. Nobody went to Senator McCain and said, hey, I'll put my stars on the table and I'm ready to go today, but I've got to tell you the truth because I need to hold myself to the same moral standard that I'm holding them to in country. And I'm telling them to go out and fight like Americans, in some cases die like Americans, right, to acquit themselves well. I've got to do the same thing. And it doesn't seem like, whether we're talking about Iraq, Vietnam, or the expansion of the ground war in Afghanistan, right, that we have people that are willing to do that, and which is very disturbing. Very disturbing. So these military endeavors that we undertake that ought to be, you know, military operations are politics by other means. We're doing this to achieve some kind of political end state that we believe in is in the nation's best interest. Well, if it's fundamentally flawed, who will tell you that? The politicians? I think we all know that the question about the war in Iraq was this is the question that got asked. How is it polling in the district? Oh, 80-20, therefore. 80-20, therefore.
Yeah.
And I'll give you one better. You know, hardly any congressmen or senators went down and read the classified intel assessment. Right? So how did they make up their mind? And so if that's the reality, if there's not military people that look at this and say, you know what? You know, this is wrong, and we'll stand up and articulate that in public because that's the only thing politicians understand, then there is no break on this because our politicians are neither experienced enough or, dare I say, honest enough to make those assessments. And that's why I think, you know, that it's more important now that our general officers stand up and say, I'm not a bobblehead. If I don't agree with you, right, I'll resign, and tomorrow, you know, I'll be in front of the cameras and saying that this is wrong. So anyway, that's why I think this topic is so important.
Yeah. So let me play devil's advocate with you, because you know I agree with you. You're right. Absolutely right.
Right.
So I'll play devil's advocate. I will say, hey, that's the price of having an all-volunteer force. You have a very small smaller percentage of the U.S. population that has served in the military.
Right.
And without the prospect of universal service, you've got nothing to drive public interest or congressional action. We've all seen it. I mean, the wars are hardly mentioned in the debates leading up to the elections, and they weren't in the last election. They will never be, because that is not the bread and butter of what your average politician is interested in, as you said. So let me push back, because these are some of the counterarguments that I've heard. And by the way, when I wrote an article on this topic back in 2010, there were calls for my resignation. General Nella, who then headed up Marine Corps University, had to answer questions on my article in the Hask, along the lines of, you know, why are you tolerating this type of thought? It undermines in a wholesale fashion the concept of civilian control of the military upon which a democratic society is based. A dude named Dr. Richard Cohen, who has set himself up as being a military historian, although he himself very carefully avoided going into the military during the Vietnam era.
Interesting how it works like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? So he wrote an article for Foreign Policy that was lauded by Thomas Ricks, again calling for my resignation, saying that my article should be read in every service academy, every entry-level officer program, as an example of the type of reckless thinking that will unhinge the U.S. military. So there is a lot of emotion tied up amongst academics and civilian policy wonks.
But you know, did they not understand?
They see what you just said. They see what you just said and what I wrote about as being a challenge of civilian control of the military.
Well, it's not, though, because...
It's not. Absolutely not.
I'm going to resign my... I'm going to refuse to do that. I'll resign my commission, and then I will vent my spleen in public, because I think that's my moral obligation to the nation.
That's right. So in a nutshell, what you just said, and I agree with, and I stated in the article, is in a properly functioning democratic society, then the way it's supposed to work in the United States is that it's Congress's role to push back on the executive if the executive is pursuing foreign policy aims that just don't seem coherent and are resulting in a waste of blood and treasure. But as you also pointed out, and I double tapped, Congress just doesn't have an incentive to do that. And except for a few brief flurries, there has been very little serious congressional interest in foreign policy in the conduct of our wars in the last 20 years. In fact, there hasn't even been a challenge to the authorized use of military force that was passed back in 2001, for Christ's sake. And so that continues as kind of a blank check for the executive. And as you commented, if it's not Congress who's going to push back, and we're still seeing dudes die in a military campaign that is not matched by any coherent policy, then who is it who should push back? And to say that, you know, military leadership does have a responsibility to push back is not to challenge the concept of civilian control. It's an absolutely healthy safety mechanism. But it takes moral courage. And moral courage doesn't mean, hey, my role is just to offer best military advice, and if that's not taken, that's not my fault. I'm just going to go ahead and execute. You know, no. You know, I think both of us probably agree. No, there's a step beyond that. If you offer your best military advice and then all you offer is loyalty to a broken policy, then you own the results of that policy, to include the broken, you know, servicemen that and far less important, the absolute waste in this country's resources that results from that. I don't think that's commonly understood. And you know, how many generals have we seen really resign? You mentioned Ubal, who was actually my former MU commander and is a hero of mine. But not only resigning, there's been very little vocal pushback on stuff.
No, it you know what, Andy, I've made the same observation, and a lot of them are guys that both of us know and like and respect. But in terms of coming home, and I even say, look, just do it post command, right? Because I know you've worked your whole life to get here, and I know what you're going to tell me is, you know, I can do more good inside than I can outside. You know, what am I going to? I'll get a week of notoriety because of this, and then I'm done. And so I know, but you don't you have a moral obligation to do that? If that's what, if we don't have enough bodies in there, don't you have a moral obligation to come back and confront Don Rumsfeld?
So here's the counter argument that gets thrown at me all the time, Mac. And by the way, this will probably make you laugh. I received among the kind comments that I received on LinkedIn, and by the way, I welcome criticism, was one guy who reminded me of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, what that, you know, that demanded that I obey orders. I was a hair's breadth away from replying to him, you know, hey, thank you for your input to national security. But here's what people will throw back at you. And I think it's a reasonable argument. They will say, what gives you the right to decide whether policy objectives make sense or not? And in answer to that argument, I would say, it's not a question of what gives you the right. It's a question of, hey, you've got to exercise your moral judgment, and you may be wrong, but whether you're right or wrong, you're going to face the consequences, and you understand that. And that is what these Chicken Little civilian academics, and I don't mean to, you know, I'm not dismissive of civilian academics, but the ones who fear that it's one step away from sanctioning or even saying that officers are sometimes obligated to disobeying orders, that it's one step away from that to now we really have a threat of a military coup in this country. And there are guys in the civilian academic world who really believe that. But my point is, we're a long way away from that, because the way that our military culture and military system is set up, there are consequences, quite rightly, there are consequences for deciding to disobey an order. And, you know, as you pointed out, a termination of your career, a career that you've poured a great amount into, public, you know, approbation.
These
are never going to be taken lightly.
No,
never.
General Allen, when he spoke at, you know, Hillary Clinton's nomination, I mean, he was excoriated for that.
That's right. Right. Yeah.
I mean, he lost lifelong friends over that. And, you know, and so I agree with you. And I mean, but I think if history teaches us a lesson, right, I think there's two great lessons in our history. One is if you fail to confront totalitarianism, all you're doing is making the conflict greater at some point down the road. And the second one is, if you're in a position, right, to have input on policy and you don't believe the policy's right, you have a moral obligation to the nation and the rest of the world, I'll say, to make sure that your perspective is raised and addressed. And if it doesn't, because, I mean, all you have to do is look at the Middle East now. The neoconservatives of the Bush administration have destabilized an entire region of the world that's bled into Europe and has caused major issues for France and Germany, as well as Greece and Italy. And you see it, and that was all something the United States launched. And so if it's not right, how do you not act? You're not a bobblehead. You don't take the oath of a bobblehead. You take an oath to the nation. You take an oath to the young men and women that we lead, not to send them home in an aluminum can for no reason at all. And so I think that moral obligation is inherent in your oath.
Mac, that's absolutely right. And I state that in the article. And then, you know, I talk about your obligation to your oath to the Constitution, and, you know, my point there is, that requires some interpretation, and it is up to every individual officer to interpret what that means in a given situation. But you can never interpret it simply as meaning, hey, that just means I obey what I do what I'm told, because that is, that is just that shows either lack of intellectual depth or lack of moral courage or both. And then, I talk about how weighty that obligation is at the highest levels. But then I talk about at every stage of your career, you are confronted with these same decisions. A lot of us are about whether to exercise your moral autonomy. And it isn't simply about the principles of mission command, if you can see a better way of accomplishing the objective. Sometimes you may think that the objective itself is not the right objective. For instance, a purely hypothetical situation. You're told to cover up the name of a U.S. Navy ship because that name may cause political embarrassment.
Interesting hypothetical, Andy.
Yeah. I mean, it's far-fetched, I know. But by doing so, you are bringing, frankly, disgrace to your service. But on more prosaic terms, think about the sailors who served on that ship, and that particular ship, a number of whom died in the last couple of years.
Can I give you a further hypothetical? And let's just say hypothetically, no military officer raises an objection.
That's what's so disturbing. That's what prompted me to write this article. And similar incidences, we talked a couple of days ago, I think, about the McCain and Fitzgerald and the collision at sea, and the decisions. And, I commented about all the things that had led to those accidents, but the decisions by the captains of those two ships, who knew that their crews were not ready to go to sea, to put to sea nevertheless, which, by the way, is another great example of the mission versus the men. They put to sea even though it was a mission that they could not accomplish, and even though it risked and ultimately resulted in their men paying their price. These are not easy questions to answer, and the problem is that people want it broken down into black and white, and that is nothing that you or I could do, or any commissioned officer. But that is why having a commission is such a valuable thing. That is why you can't just willy-nilly give a commission to anyone. And I love that quote from, and I used this at the beginning of my article, and I may have learned this at IOC, actually, because it was a quote used by von Moltke, the elder, but he tells the story of the Austro-Prussian War of 1866, a Prussian officer made some mistake that resulted in a tactical loss on the battlefield, and he defended himself from reprimand by saying, "Hey, listen, I was just following orders." And his corps commander, Prince Frederick Charles, replied, "His Majesty gave you a commission, made you a major, because he believed that you would know when to disobey an order." And that was, that's over 200 years ago. And yet there are guys, there are those in the civilian academic world who would deny us the same moral autonomy that was expected of a Prussian officer 200 years ago.
Yes, you
have a commission so that because your country thinks that you would know when to disobey an order.
I want to ask you a question about, we're talking about disobeying orders, and this kind of, this is a grunt's perspective, but we have something called commander's intent that allows you to operate if your mission is irrelevant. And so you're not talking about operating under the realm of commander's intent and maybe changing your task to be more in accordance with NOCOM, a changing situation, and commander's intent. You're not talking about that.
I regard that as being inarguable. So I'm talking. And the reason why this is controversial is, yes, of course, commander's intent sometimes means that you will find a different way to accomplish the mission that wasn't foreseen by your commander at the time that he gave you the orders. So you disobey certain tasks, but you still accomplish the purpose of the mission. where it becomes controversial, and the point that I'm making is sometimes the purpose of the mission makes no sense. Sometimes, you know, so if you take mission command to its logical conclusion, here's another approach to this problem, and you're defining a different way to accomplish the mission, sometimes when you're looking at that mission, again, it either doesn't make sense or it is destructive, and you can achieve a better outcome by not even pursuing that mission. This is where people go off the rails and start yelling at me that, hey, who are you to decide? Well, great example. Again, is, you know, it's just a recent example, the McCain incident. But I can give you other examples from my own career, at least five that I put in this article. And let me just, you know, let me just provide some parameters to what I'm saying here. You know, they say what are they called? It's like the first duty that doctors have is to do no harm.
Right.
And for us as military officers, it's, you know, it's kind of your first duty is don't be an idiot, right? So you can't willy-nilly just disobey orders because you have a better idea. You've got to be guided by something, and that's what I say in the article is you're guided by your professional ethics, and that isn't just Milburn spouting BS. That's actually was something that was said by General Milley in an interview back in 2017. General Milley, who's going to be chief of staff of the Army, where I would take it further than what General Milley says.
He's going to be chairman. He's now chairman of the Joint Chief.
The chairman, yeah. I had been reading the papers, but you know, my point is that yes, sometimes that will lead you, your professional ethics will lead you to do something that doesn't accomplish the mission that you have been given. Again, I give examples in the article, but you've got to be guided by that, by your own ethics. Not by your own ethics, by your professional ethics. I didn't word that part well. It isn't just simply, I don't agree with that, I don't like that. Some examples, all right, not from my own career, but remember what we talked about again the other day, coalition provisional authority order number one or two, whichever it was, that totally dissolved the Ba'ath Party and thus set the conditions for a counterinsurgency that would cost thousands of lives and have us mired in Iraq for 8 years. Now, there were a lot of people at the time who disagreed with that order within the military. Right. And I think I mentioned that General Petraeus outright disobeyed it. Was he wrong? I don't think so. And I'd like to think that if I had been in charge of whatever it was then, whether it was multinational force yet, I'd like to think that I would have said, hey, no, we are not doing that. Is that wrong? And that's coming from civilian authority. There are those who would say, no, that is inviolate. That is, you must obey that as a military officer. But I would like to think that I would be willing to risk my career and say absolutely, absolutely not, because the reasonable man in that position could foresee the disastrous results that particular idiotic order would have. Just a couple of examples. And here's another, none of these discussions are political. There are guys, again, who get up in arms thinking that I'm making a political statement about the current administration. I wrote that essay under the original essay in 2010 under the Obama administration. It doesn't matter who's in power. The argument, the rationale remains the same. Here's another example, show you how murky the waters are. Enhanced interrogation methods, all right? We're told you obey any order that is not illegal.
Well, illegal, immoral, or unethical, right? Those are three.
Well, yeah. But I'll tell you, the purists will tell you it's only when those orders are legal. And I'll throw back at the purists that sometimes you've no way of telling if that order is illegal. Enhanced interrogation methods were only found subsequently by the Supreme Court to be illegal. So what if the time you're ordered to execute them and you disobey because your professional ethics lead you to think, hey, this is somewhat akin to torture, and I don't think Americans do that. Again, the traditionalist approach would go after you for that. Say, yours not to reason why, buddy. And yet, subsequently you would have been vindicated. Again, that is not a political argument. That is simply to illustrate again that these are not easy issues. Right. And if you want it spelled out for you, and if you really want it in black and white, maybe you shouldn't be holding a commission in the U.S. military.
And I'll throw it, and you know, you would hear robust discussions about that subject, because, you know, there were guys who felt that, look, if they have time-sensitive information, and I'm talking about you just yoked them up, and we believe that, let's just say there's going to be a complex, you know, attack on something, you know, there would be guys who say, hey, look, you absolutely, you know, to save your own, you know, Marines and soldiers, you absolutely should use enhanced interrogation techniques. And you would hear these incredibly intense discussions about our duty, our responsibility to our own Marines and soldiers on the ground if you thought somebody had time-sensitive information, right? And so, I mean, so to me, that's part of all this, is that most of these positions don't get taken lightly. And they're extremely weighty issues.
You're talking about they are. Life, and you can go round and round on that right. particular argument, because right. there are those who would argue that actually torture doesn't. There's no, you know, I don't know if anyone's done studies on this, but there are those who argue coherently that torture doesn't result in you getting good information necessarily. A lot of times people will tell you anything to avoid, you know, to stop the torture. But in the end, right. I think it comes back to what do your professional ethics lead you to do, and you follow that path, and you have enough moral courage to follow that path. You know, so, again, I mentioned that three guys actually wrote an article. It's not really counter to my article. It came out the following, I think about 2 weeks after mine and War on the Rocks. But it does accuse me of making a sweeping statement. And I would argue, no, read my article again. There isn't a sweeping statement in there, man. I break it down to three sources for disobeying orders. But I do say, yeah, there isn't an answer to every what if. Every hypothetical, and that is why, again, having a commission is such a weighty responsibility. Or on a much lighter note, you know, to paraphrase my senior drill instructor, Staff Sergeant Chavez, used to tell us, hey, listen, privates, you can come up with a what if grandma had a dick hypothetical for every single situation, but you've got to take action. You've got to be guided by your own, you know, by your own conscience.
Talk to me about, do you have a responsibility? What's your responsibility if you do choose to disobey that order?
That's a great question, Mac. And honestly, if I was to attack my own argument, his where I think is the weakest point. And I said it's the weakest point, but I still think it's, and you know, I stand by my argument, but here's the counter argument. So in my example, I don't conflate. In my examples that I give, I took about five times that I actually disobeyed an order, you know, at different stages of my career. And I say, yeah. Look, in my career, I've made foolish decisions, but I don't count any of those decisions in that category. And to lend them coherence, in every case, I believe I was guided by the ethics of my profession. I believe that what I was doing would lead to a better outcome for, you know, what I would call loosely the institution, you know, the overarching mission, as well as for those involved.
I have another question for you.
Yeah.
Do the way the oath of enlistment for officers and enlisted contain, does the difference lay a greater moral responsibility on the officer to, in fact, disobey when it's significant or not?
Very much so. You know, I think we talked about this a couple of days ago. So the enlisted oath is, they promise to, enlisted personnel promise to obey all those placed over them. We do not significantly in our order. I mean, we promise to well and faithfully discharge the duties upon the office upon which we're about to enter and have no mental reservations, et cetera, et cetera. But we significantly do not promise to obey. And I'm not, you know, this isn't me trying to read so extra messages into that. It is an absolutely, it places an implicit weighty responsibility on us to ensure that we don't order our subordinates to do dumb things, because they have sworn an oath to obey us, right? By dumb, I mean, you know, you name it, whether it's covering the flag of covering the name of the ship, or to do things that'll lead to their deaths for absolutely no purpose. And just, you know, to get back to your other point, which is a great point, which was disobedience or dissent. The higher up the chain you get, the greater weight dissent carries. One of the problems with dissenting lower down the chain is that, A, there often isn't the time to argue the point, and B, you can simply be replaced, you know, and so your dissent will have absolutely no outcome. You'd probably be replaced in a hurry. But at four star level, dissent, public pushback before resignation, carries a great deal of weight. Or at least it should.
Well, I would submit to you, and let me read a sentence. These examples illustrate that America has more to fear. This is from your article. From an officer corps of automatons, which I call bobbleheads, than from one that accepts a role for dissent and within its dissent within its profession. I want you to talk about that, because I believe, in my heart of hearts, I believe that so strongly, and I believe that again, all you have to do, I mean, imagine if we'd never gone to Iraq. I mean, imagine, you know, us still with a no-fly zone or not, you know, the Middle East largely intact, Saddam Hussein still around in some way, shape, or form, but none of this other craziness, you know, have ensued, to include the money that it costs to pay for all the craziness. I mean, imagine that. Imagine no expansion of the ground war in Afghanistan, that we went, we hunted Osama bin Laden, you know, we got the Taliban out of there, and then we looked at the Afghan government and said, hey, look, we have no interest in being involved in anything beyond this point. But if you stack two bricks on top of each other that we don't like, we'll come back and we'll knock it over. Right, we will never again have this, and that's our promise. And because I mean, why would you? I mean, imagine the difference in our, you know, in the country today, and in the world today, and it's just, it's immoral to go on these things that and then not pledge the assets to them, not finish them, not win phase four, not create what you set out to create, and then ask people to die for it. I mean, if you talk about the anguish of Vietnam, it is that anguish. 58,000 people gave the only life they'll ever have.
And hundreds of thousands of others wrecked. And that's just the U.S. toll.
Right, that's just the U.S. Millions. Yeah. If you talk about Vietnam and Southeast Asia, millions. And so, you know, you look at that and you say, okay, and then, you know, General Johnson's quote comes back to your head. I have to go to my grave knowing that I didn't do my moral duty to the people that depended on me. And so I just think that sentence is, if you want more, you know, Iraqs, then have a whole bunch of bobblehead officers. But the problem is that, you know, did anybody dissent relative to Beirut? Did anybody dissent relative to Somalia? Did anybody dissent relative to Iraq? Did anybody dissent? And did they do it in a public way? And I think the numbers are very small, and yet the mistakes are so glaring. And yeah. And I don't say this in just light of the rearview mirror, because that's easy. But when you have guys like Tony Zinni, who I refer to as a burning bush, when you have guys like him saying, I don't know what planet they're on, because we don't need to do this. okay? And of the 8 most important things that are going on in CENTCOM, you can only do 5 of them. And this would be 7 or 8. And so it's not even close because you can't afford to do it. And yet, you know, a guy like him, Rumsfeld's reply was, I don't even know who Tony Zinni is. Who is he? Right? I mean, that kind of bullshit. And so, but again, Zinni was not on active duty at the time. He had been Bill Clinton's envoy to the Middle East, and he had retired, blah, 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 blah. And so I think that, you know, our general officers have to be the moral conscience of the nation. And they also have to have all that experience to know that, you know, look, I think it's great, the OPT, but what happens if everything you said doesn't work?
Yep.
What happens if they reject the expat government? What happens if the war plan's right and Secretary Rumsfeld's wrong and 135 isn't going to be enough and you need 300,000 and you're going to need them to be there for 5 years? Can we afford that? Will the American people support that? Because that's what the war plan says. Okay, and I have great respect for, you know, Don Rumsfeld, you know. He's a genius. Everybody knows that. But what happens, what's the course of action if we have to go there?
Crickets. You nailed it there, and I think you can answer, I think you can also answer that question in terms that don't even go to those specifics. I mean, you cite great examples, but you can answer that question simply by reminding people that try though it may sound, it is true that we are entrusted with the nation's lifeblood. We're trusted, you know, by the American public with the, you know, the lives of their most precious asset. And so what a cop-out it is to then simply say, oh, and hey, listen, we're going to execute that responsibility simply by obeying anything that we are told. That's something you need to understand as a second lieutenant. And as we talked about it, and as you've just shown by those examples, the effects of those decisions and the burden of that responsibility gets weightier and weightier the higher up the chain that you go. And at no point, I believe, can you ever simply resort to saying, hey man, that was obeying orders. It was a legal order, so I obeyed it. Those lives, they're not on my conscience because, hey man, that's what I was told to do. That's not why we give guys commissions. And that is not what the American public expects of us. What gives me the right to say that? I think it goes back to let me rephrase that. That shouldn't be what the American public expects of us. And it gets back to you reminding us that Sunday afternoon in the woods there at Quantico of our implicit pact with the American people. It's a two-way pact. Anyone who denies that, again, within our profession, I think is a very dangerous person to give a commission to.
Why does it happen so infrequently, Andy?
Yeah, I can't answer that.
What do you mean? I brought you on the program.
I think it comes down to the fact that the Marine Corps just didn't make me a 4-star general.
Had they made you one, you'd be able to answer that? Let me give you the answer and tell me what you think of it. I'll make my splash for 2 weeks. They'll be done with me, and I can do more good. You know, I can do more good on the inside than I can on the outside. So what I do would be of no consequence. So I choose to do more good on the inside.
That's not wrong if you do good on the inside. But if what you do on the inside is simply go ahead and execute the military campaign when there's no real policy objectives that align with that campaign or that which that campaign leads to, then that is a very poor answer. You know, if you're going to tell me, yes, absolutely, I will stay within the system, but I will work with my civilian colleagues, my civilian masters, to ensure that they do develop a strategy, an overarching strategy, so that this military campaign leads to something and it makes sense, and that the guys who are dying die for a cause, that their sacrifice serves some end. But I can't think of a single example where that's happened. Can you?
No, and that's my problem with it, is that do we have too many conformists that are general officers? Do we need to have a quota for rebellious loudmouth generals? 10% need to be those guys so that somebody will hold somebody accountable? And when you look at the magnitude, right, when you look at, I mean, again, the mistakes that the Navy's made in the 7th Fleet, I would say this, and that's just what we know. And the example I use is Bill Clinton and his buddies. Like, oh, God, man, they went crazy, you know, about Monica Lewinsky. Could you imagine if they found out about XYZ?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, what you don't know, right? And so, you know, that's what we know about the 7th Fleet. I don't know. For me, it's tremendously disconcerting. And I've had people say to me, well, what about if you vent your spleen in private and then you get to a salute point? How about that? And I say, well, okay. I mean,
then you own the consequences.
Right. Right.
That's my point. If you do salute and execute, okay, that's fine. But you own those consequences. Every one of your subordinates who sacrifices his life because of that decision is, you own responsibility for that. And that's, again, that's not me being self-indulgent. That's the truth. And sometimes, you know, you can live with that if you understand that that's what's required of the cause. We're all in the military. We understand that sometimes, you know, all of us, when we took that oath, knew that it could result in our deaths. That's an implicit part of the contract that no one forced us to sign. That's all good. Don't get me wrong. In wars, people die. But my point is that the wars should have a purpose. And I think what we're both agreeing on here is that the apex of military leadership, you do have a responsibility ensuring that that purpose exists.
Do they have a greater responsibility now than before, or has it always been the same responsibility?
Great question. I would guess that it's only greater now because in the past civilian leaders tended to have had some military background. Now, believe me, there are guys probably listening to this, me say that, who will absolutely rip me out for saying that. I do not, and so let me add, I don't necessarily believe, of course I don't believe you need a military background in order to be a successful politician. That's not what I'm saying. But if you look at, even back in, 30, 40 years, much higher percentage of the country's civilian leadership came from a military background. Why does that even matter or count? I think it probably matters a little bit. And I'll give you some examples from two radically different administrations, the Trump administration, Obama administration. Bear in mind, listeners, this is not political, so I'll play it out with both sides, okay? Remember the go-round that we had back in 2009 on troop numbers in Afghanistan.
Right.
Now, perhaps a leader with some military background would have said, it doesn't matter what the numbers are. What is the in order to? What is the strategy? And then I'll tell you what the numbers are. But instead, we had this ridiculous quibbling about brigades and numbers without any real sense of what it was all for. Later in the whole question of red lines in Syria, should we be committed or should we not? I never saw a coherent, what is in order to, and what will it take to do that? It was a question of shall we or shall we? And we see the same sort of discussions now under the current administration. You know, it's this. So I'm wary of saying that. You know, having said it, I'm wary of saying that responsibility is greater now because maybe it's just I'm shaped by, you know, I'm looking at events now, and I assume that these are quite unusual, and they require a greater responsibility. Maybe it's always been the same. Maybe it's because, you know, until the Second World War, the issues, at least from a point of national security, a strategy, seemed a little more straightforward than they do now.
Well, and, you know, truth be told, we have more information now, right? I mean, we tend to not have. No, I think it's one of the most significant issues in contemporary civil military relations, and that because these mistakes of American foreign power are, you know, are beneath the special place that American occupies in the world, on the world stage. And for those of us that have gone around the world, and people, you know, scoff at the idea of American exceptionalism, if you do, you need to get out there and go around the world to the places. And I don't mean to go to Paris. I mean, go to the Philippines, right? Go to the Arab world and go to Afghanistan. See how people live. Yeah. And the United States represents the hope for many of these countries about what it is to live as a free person. And when we're a diminished country, that's bad for the world. Because the world more in China's orbit is not a better place. And so to me, our credibility as a nation, the causes we sign up for are incredibly important to people all around the world who look to the United States not to be diminished, but to be great and to stand up for what's right and do the right things. And so when we do make huge mistakes like we've made in Iraq and Afghanistan, I just find it extremely troubling because, you know, the world as dictated by the Chinese is not going to be a good place. And so, all right, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you about? And again, my guest, Andy Milburn, the article is entitled When Not to Obey Orders. You can find it on the website War on the Rocks, or you can just click on this post. This is the general question. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want people to know before we conclude
you've been extremely, extremely thorough, and I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for inviting me on, it's a great honor to be able to talk to you and your listeners. Well, I think what you're doing here is just an awesome venue.
No, again, as you and I talked before we came on the air, Almarine Radio is a wonderful forum to continue discussions that, you know, you and I had many years ago about much less lofty things at the infantry officer course, and I think it's a great resource for young leaders. Whether they're going to listen to General Mattis for 70 minutes talk about discipline, or General Van Riper do the same, and I enjoy doing a little bit, but I hope you don't mind in the future, Andy, if I call you and bring you back on, because I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and you have a great perspective, and you're not opposed to writing and sharing it.
Absolutely, Mac. It would be a great pleasure.
All right. Andy Milburn, more of Almarine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. That'll do it on a Wednesday. My thanks to Andy Milburn for giving up his time all week to talk to us about a few things. One is his career, two, living with traumatic stuff, both personally and professionally. And being as candid as he was about that. If you missed yesterday's interview, you should check that out. And then, finally, today, getting around to the discussion that we talked about. So, have a great day. Lynch and Kenny tomorrow. But on Wednesday, Almarine Radio. Over and out.